All right, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to SaberSims DFS Office Hours. It is Wednesday, April 27th of 2022. Been a little while since I've been on stream here today. Took a little bit of a long weekend here, a little short vacation, but I'm excited to be back. Dearly missed the Office Hours stream and DFS as a whole. I was down in Orlando, Florida for a few days, taking a little time, getting a little R&R in, but I'm excited to be back at it here for the remainder of this week, at least. My name's Jordan. I'm the head coach here at SaberSim. If this is your first time watching or listening to our show here, this is a live open Q&A style show where I answer questions from the SaberSim community about SaberSim, about DFS, any questions you guys have about how to build better DFS lineups. You can put your questions into YouTube chat or in the Office Hours channel in Slack, and we tackle questions in roughly chronological order with a priority to the questions that are coming in Slack. I start there, typically start the stream there. So if you're not already in Slack, there is a link to join the Slack community in the description of every past show. Once this show is up as a recording up on YouTube, there'll be a link in the description of this show. And I definitely recommend joining up into Slack. You'll get the opportunity to ask those priority questions in that channel, but you also get access to our free prop bets posted daily in the sports betting channel here. You'll get access to the sim alerts channels, which will let you know when sims are running for certain games. It's also plugged into the Underdog Twitter news Twitters, I guess, and it'll let you know when news is breaking and things like that. You also get access to the entire community at large. So definitely important part of being a part of SaberSim here is joining up in the community. So strongly recommend doing that. If you are watching this, consuming this content here as the recording on YouTube as well, make sure to subscribe, or I guess even for those of you watching along with me live, make sure you subscribe if you haven't already. We do this show every Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern, but when you subscribe, you get the nice little notifications on your phone or your device so you know when we're going live so you don't ever miss a show. And there will be a time-stamped order of the questions we talk about in the show in the description as well. So if you want to bounce around looking for an answer to a specific question or just want to see what we talk about in the show, always in the description as the timestamps. We've got a few different things to talk about here on stream today. We did make a couple cool updates to our baseball model in the last couple days to account for a few things going on this season and just overall improvement. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what has gone into that. And we'll get into some questions. So I see one question at the moment about stacking, creating five stacks for your baseball lineups with SaberSim. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll see what else comes in. So I'm going to go ahead and get our app pulled up here, and we'll go ahead and put this up on screen and talk a little bit here about our MLB model update. So let me get the notes I have ready for this here, and we'll go from there. Okay, so let's get this here. So yeah, updates to the baseball model over the weekend here accounted for a few different things, or really improved upon a few different things. So I'll keep this kind of high level, but mostly just wanted to let you guys know that this is out there and we're always continuing to work on these models as sports go along. So first of all, improvements to the way that we are handling weather and umpires for this season. So some more accurate weather effects and umpire effects in terms of the way that they are going to affect the game. We also improved our what's called a decay rate. The decay rate is essentially how much are we going to value the most recent information we have for players, what players have done recently versus their long-term form, I guess, what we understand about that player over the long term. Made basically actually the real tweak that was made there is we actually toned down some of our short-term form there. Felt like we were maybe overweighting a little bit short-term, underweighting long-term there, so made some improvements there. We made an improvement to our pitcher leash logic, how long certain pitchers will get to continue to stay in the game based on their pitch counts, how many runs they've given up, how efficient they've been with their pitches overall. Pretty cool update and something very unique to simulating games, baseball games, play-by-play or by each at-bat is that we have to think about these kinds of things. It's important to the simulation of the game. Who's pitching? Who's on the mound? How long the starting pitcher got to pitch? So some improvements there. And we've also made some adjustments to our model based on what news is coming out around the baseball itself this year. It seems like there's pretty compelling data at this point that the ball that is being used for baseball games is pretty dead. Hitting in general is down. Home runs are down. So we did make some improvements there to account for that as well. So always something we're working on. We'll continue to monitor and continue working on the baseball model as we move forward in the season. But some exciting updates to the MLB model. So really, really excited about that. And I, for one, having not played any baseball DFS here or any DFS at all in about a week, I'm very excited to get back in. I'm playing the early slate here today. I get really excited, though, to get into the main slate here tonight and mess around a little bit. So just wanted to give everybody a quick update there. From there, let's go ahead and jump into the first question I have in the queue here for today. This was from 12-pack in Slack. And let's go ahead and get this pulled up here. Oh, he said, welcome back. Thank you. Let's get you rolling with a big wordy question. Perfect. I am trying to force five stacks to specific teams, but can't seem to make the builder do that consistently. For example, on a particular slate, I may want all of my lineups to use five stacks from only a few specific teams. I'm setting a stacking rule, selecting only the teams I want. If I select three teams, I may only see one or two of them as five stacks. Am I misunderstanding the stacking rule logic? I can, of course, adjust in step three, but it's getting me in a cycle of trying to expand the pool. So let's talk about this here. It is possible that there is a bug, and I'll show you what to do if you're having an issue with a bug here. But it seems like you've got a pretty good grasp on this. So I'm going to refresh the projections here quickly and show everybody else at least how to set these stacking rules, and we'll see what happens here. But in the build settings, once you've selected your contest, et cetera, we'll go over to the rules tab and then into the stacking tab, which is the default option here, and then add a basic rule. And then what we'll do is we'll say we want the rule to say at least five players from the same team. And then we're going to, I think if you only have a few specific teams you want to use here, I normally like to remove all of the teams and we'll just add in the ones we want. So let's actually take a quick look at the slate. So maybe we'll do Yankees, Toronto, and Atlanta. Highest implied totals on the slate for these three teams. Maybe kind of a chalky direction, but that's okay. We'll do that for the sake of example. So Atlanta, New York, and Toronto. So every lineup here will have a five stack from one of these three teams. And then obviously can edit your positions if you want here or your batting order spots. For now, I'm just going to leave that alone and start a build. And what we should get out of this, here is five stacks of those teams. And we will see once this build is complete if that's working correctly. Now, one thing to note here is this does not mean that you are guaranteed to get equal exposure to all of those different teams. You may need to make some adjustments there in step three, but we'll see what happens here and go from there. So but let's see. All right, our build is finishing up here now. Okay, so we do have a five stack in every lineup, and our five stacks, okay, so here's actually a good example. So we have 85% five stacks for New York, 15% five stacks for Toronto. No Atlanta Braves here, but the rule is satisfied in this particular case. If we wanted to even out our exposure a little bit more, we can set, for example, 40% exposure to New York. Let's do 40% exposure to Toronto. And then that starts to leak in a little bit of those Atlanta stacks. But every lineup, even into our pool, should be, let's actually scroll down a little bit and just get into the random lineups in here, should be a five stack of each team. So it appears to be that appears to be the way to do it here. It looks like this worked, at least in my particular case. Now, I know, I mean, 12-pack, it sounds like you had a pretty good grasp on what you were, whoops. Accidentally hit the button on my mouse here, on what to do here. So, it's possible there is a bug where, you know, these stacking rules aren't working correctly. But, it seems like that's That's the way to do it. So if there is a build where you set the stacking rule and you are still running into issues and it's not working correctly, something's kind of going wrong, what I would do is click the settings and then report a problem and just let us know, you know, something like, you know, set a 5-stack rule for XYZ and got stacks of ABC. So, that is what I would do there. So Tovac said, I could swear there was a max exposure. Oh, I actually reported that. All right. Well, I'll let the support team ignore that one. Tovac said, I could swear there was a max exposure dialogue on the rule set that doesn't seem to be there today. Interesting. I think at some point we did have this. We did have an exposure here. I believe was removed, mostly because the exposure was kind of awkward to use. It would apply to the rule at large rather than for individual teams. So you could get something like, you know, you could set a 50% max exposure to this rule, but all it would do would say only 50% of the lineups need to have this rule in effect at all. It was just kind of awkward, not very intuitive for what people were actually trying to use this for. I haven't seen it in a while here, but I think one other thing too is, you know, in some ways, when you set a stacking rule, you are restricting the types of lineups that the builder can build, right? You are saying every lineup must have a 5-stack of these teams. And because of that, the diversity of your lineups is going to be a little bit lower. You're going to be a little bit more condensed onto those teams. If you wanted to build 5 stacks of only 3 teams, for example, but wanted to be generally evened out on your exposures to those teams, one thing I would experiment would be setting the sim variance at a higher setting here, maybe even as high as 10, and then using that rule. Because you are kind of naturally counteracting the effect of the sim variance slider going so high with the stack rule you have set. So I think if you want to say stack these 5 teams and I want roughly equal exposures to these teams, I think setting the stacking rule there, cranking up your sim variance setting and then using the exposures in step 3 to fine tune is probably the best way to do that. So. If you are running into an issue where there is a bug in particular, and a bug would definitely be something I think like where you are setting a 5-stack rule and you are getting a team that is 5-stacked that is not included. Oh, that's just a bug. Okay. That's not, when I hit cancel, it's reporting it. But anyway, if you are setting a 5-stack rule with a team and a team that's not even in your rule is getting into your 5-stacks, that would be incorrect. So I would definitely report that to us if that happens. So. Cool. Let's get into this next one here. This is from Ryan. This came in Slack as well. And this is an interesting one. This is a fun one. We've talked about this a little bit here before, recently this season. He said, hey, Jordan, is there a way to estimate team stack ownership in SaberSim for MLB? And there isn't explicitly. There are a few different ways that I like to experiment with this, or where I think you can kind of approximate team stack ownership. I mean, the first and probably one of the easiest, well, I don't want to say the easiest, probably like the lightest load to do here is to just, you know, take either the midpoint batter ownership, the individual batter ownership, and use that as an approximation for team stack ownership. So maybe the fourth or fifth most batter on the team, right? If you were trying to approximate stack ownership of a particular team, I think that does a pretty good approximation. And it's pretty easy to just do that. You can kind of see here, you know, let's find, where's the chalk tonight? You know, probably the Braves, right? It seems like the Braves are going to be pretty chalky, right? So you can see, you know, Braves stacks probably decently approximated tonight as like 16% of the lineups in the field will be Brave stacks. Works as a pretty decent approximation. I have also, taking that one step further, experimented with downloading the player projection CSV and then taking the average of the top five highest owned projected players and using that as team stack ownership. There is, I think, another option here is to use the Fantasy Labs dashboard that we've talked about here, the MLB Vegas Fantasy Labs dashboard. And what you can do here is just basically take the implied live totals and take a look and approximate. This will not approximate the actual percentage of lineups that will have a certain stack in it, but I do think just purely using Vegas totals alone is a pretty good way to identify what will be the chalkiest stacks. Right, so you can kind of see Vegas would imply to us that the Braves, Yankees, and Toronto will probably be the three chalkiest stacks, then probably the Angels and Astros, and then kind of everybody else almost. And you can actually even kind of do this a little bit with pitchers too on the other side. I think those are two pretty good approximations. If you want to take this one step further, one thing that you can do here is I think running a build where you... This gets a little tricky, but I think one thing you can do is adjust your team totals for each team to match Vegas. So, for example, let's go through and do this here, or let's do a little bit of this. So, okay. So, basically, make sure that you are approximately close to Vegas here with each of these team totals. I'm not going to do it for every single team, but getting these close, so you're removing kind of the Saber Sim bias here and essentially trying to approximate the way that the field sees the slate. So you would do this for every single team and then run a research build, right? Run a build, but instead set a stacking rule. So set a five stack rule and then build 1500 lineups at 0-0-10 settings and see what your stack ownership works out as in this research build. And I think that's another opportunity here as well. That will, I think, help potentially give you more specific and precise stack ownership for each team, but it is a little bit more involved. It kind of depends on how much time you have here. I think if you were trying to just get a gut check idea of what are going to be the chalkiest stacks, I would use some combination of just looking at the implied Vegas live totals from Fantasy Labs here and how our ownership projection looks across each individual team and use that. I do think if you're looking for a specific number here, a good way to do that is to adjust the team totals to match Vegas, run this research build, set a five-stack rule, and then you'll actually, I think, get pretty useful information here about how likely each team is to be stacked. The reason why this gets kind of hard in terms of projecting stack ownership instead of individual player ownership is because you don't really know precisely what kind of stacks the field is going to use, how much of the field is going to stack at all, and, well, I guess mostly those two things, right? So in this case, we have 1,500 lineups where we assumed every lineup has a five stack. Well, that's not actually what's going to happen. And there's a mix of three stacks and four stacks and five stacks that the field will kind of employ differently in different contests, different size contests. It gets kind of tricky. But that should give you a few different tools in your toolbox to use here to get this done. So, but cool. All right, let's keep it going here. I don't see any other questions in Slack, so we'll hop over to YouTube chat here and start tackling some of these YouTube questions that have come in here. Tamaka said, completely irrelevant nitpicking. When will you guys update the Miami Marlins logo? I didn't even notice it was the wrong one, to be totally honest. What is the... Let's see. Oh, yeah. It is. You're right. Yeah. That's true. I hadn't even noticed. I think this one looks cooler, personally. But... Yeah. I don't know. We'll get that updated there. I had no idea. Good find there. Nobody cares about the Marlins enough to update the logo, I guess. But all right, cool. Let's see, keep going here. So Nick had asked a question here. He said, 2 weeks with SaberSim, playing only GPPs. I've lost money every night. Should I start playing cash games? A couple thoughts here. First of all, a 2-week skid is perfectly normal, to be completely honest. In fact, downswings that are longer than that are also very normal. GPPs are a marathon, not a sprint. They are about realizing an edge over a long-term sample to realize your expected value in that contest. I would recommend actually a couple videos here on our YouTube channel that I think will help quite a bit here to help explain this a little bit more. So the first is on our YouTube channel, all the way down at the bottom, this Office Hours Greatest Hits playlist. I have a video here. It says, what does variance after 100 slates look like for a winning player? And in this video, what I do is I basically take a player who's essentially guaranteed to be profitable in the long term. They outpace their average expectation of top 1% lineups by a factor of two. They're essentially two times better than average. So they're virtually guaranteed to make money in the long term. But what I do is I actually demonstrate in that video that even after 100 slates, right? Keep in mind, if you played, you know, every slate, both early and main slates for 2 weeks straight, that's like probably 20 slates or so. In this video, I break down and show how after 100 slates, you can still have negative samples, right? You will have sometimes very profitable samples. You'll sometimes have break-even samples. And it shows how variant your results can be. If you are expecting to win even in every single set of 2 weeks, it is not really what is going to happen. The second point I would make there, and I guess it's kind of related, is that because of that, you need to have very strict bankroll management and contest selection principles to be successful playing GPPs and be profitable playing GPPs. So, you know, a two-week skid, even a pretty bad downswing, should not really represent a significant negative hit to your bankroll. And if it does, you're probably playing too much. So another video I would recommend watching is this one, Four Simple Rules to Build Your MLB DFS Bankroll. And in this video, I break down our bankroll management strategies, but also our contest selection strategies to maximize the growth of your bankroll in baseball DFS. If you are playing bad contests, you can be playing in a profitable way or building good lineups, but because you're entering those contests into very sharp contests, very difficult, or those lineups into very sharp contests, difficult contests to beat, you may not be as profitable as you can be, or you may be exaggerating your negative downswings, right? So I'd go and watch this too, and I would focus on playing, I guess in a nutshell, I'll summarize it, but no more than 5% of your bankroll maximum per day, essentially, per set of correlated slates, and playing a unique lineup into every single entry you're playing, and playing your entries into contests that are the most profitable ones to play first, which I break down a little bit further in this video. I would not go start playing cash games. I think GPPs are much more profitable for the average player. There's really the main reason why is there is not enough casual money in cash games to offset the rake. It is pretty easy to build profitable cash game lineups with a decent set of average projections, and an optimizer, which is very widely available. And there are not enough fish basically in the cash game pool to offset the 10 to 15% rake you need to have to beat cash games. GPPs, on the other hand, are more profitable because you have to account for things like correlation and ownership and variance and not just average projections, which is a problem that most tools out there can't really solve without a ton of rules and basically mastery of the traditional optimizer you are using to build those lineups. But because you're shooting for top 1% and top 0.1% outcomes, it takes a lot longer to realize your edge in those contests. So what I would do, Nick, I would go and watch those two videos when you have time, especially this one, because I think it will help. There's actually even kind of a point towards the end of this video where I highlight just like a subset. I think I used a week example in the video, but I just highlighted a subset week, and you can kind of actually see visually how little of that subsample a week or even 2 weeks really is in the grand scheme of things. And even across the 100 slate sample, you can still be down. You can still be negative across that period of time. So, but I would watch that. Remember the variance or learn about the variance of the GPPs a little bit. Make sure you're playing with sound bankroll management and contest selection strategies and go from there. So AK said, Jordan, with the 10-year anniversary going on for TK, there are promotional single entry unlimited pool size. Are there any tricks for these that are difficult or different than the typical single entry or 20 max? Yeah, let's go take a look at one of these here and talk about this, because I've been dabbling in these a little bit. Let's go see if we can find this. I hate this tooltip. Oh, God, that DraftKings tooltip is so annoying. I don't know if that ever happens to you guys, but I feel like I hover this and it gets stuck all the time. So, yeah, anyway, these have been pretty fun contests. So they essentially, the way I've been kind of playing these, just looking at the prize structure, right? I've been playing these like they're basically satellites here. I think they essentially are, right? We look at the payout structure. The World Series tickets, they don't actually say what the cash value is of those tickets. But I imagine this is essentially a very top-heavy contest. So what I have been doing, I haven't been doing anything like particularly strategic to target this contest, but I've been approaching my lineup construction for this contest like a satellite. So I'll kind of keep an eye out about where it ends up. I think most nights, it has essentially been a single entry 10 to 50K satellite. And that's basically just going to crank up your ownership fade and your sim variance a little bit more, right? And using something like that. And otherwise, I mean, in reality, what has ultimately ended up happening, because I end up building all of my lineups together, is I've just been taking one of the lineups from my pool that I'm using for my 150 maxes and things like that, and playing it, single entry, and playing it into this contest. But I think basically this is the right way to think about this contest, approaching it as a single entry, match the entrance up. I think every time it's been about 10 to 50K, and a satellite is the most important part. So playing with a little bit more ownership fade, being willing to play with a little bit more variance, et cetera. So one thing that I've kind of liked doing, or one thing that I kind of like doing for these kinds of contests in general, is just trying to really, really leverage directly against the field. You're trying to come in first out of whatever this is going to end up at, 30,000 lineups, basically, right? One thing that I've been liking, especially in a sport like baseball here, is to just directly leverage against the pitching chalk, especially cheaper pitching chalk. So I think like the Orioles would probably be a team that I'd be pretty interested in stacking here. Maybe even the Cubs. But just cheap pitching chalk. The expensive guys, their upside's a lot higher. I think a little bit harder to get off of some of these guys most of the time. But the cheaper, whoever that value play is, or Washington, right, playing in a hitting park. Really either side of these, I actually don't know if this is really the chalk. I think like maybe Baltimore would be a decent team to stack up here, but you can really get away with doing that. It's a uniquely baseball thing, I think, in particular, just because every team ultimately has hitting upside, right? Because players getting on base and a pitcher basically failing to get outs is literally lengthening the game for the hitting team. And there's upside for virtually every single team on the slate any given night. You don't need to go so far as stacking against the chalkiest, best projected value pitcher on every slate for a lot of contests, but for what is essentially I don't even want to say a winner take all, but it's essentially a winner take all for World Series tickets for this, about beating 20,000 plus lineups. I think that's a pretty good way to go. Because you're not only when Jordan Montgomery lineups fail, are 33% of the lineups in the field just going to be dead? You've also just got like a spectacularly low owned stack on the other side of that in the form of the Orioles, where you're suddenly competing against a very, very small pool of lineups for the rest of your lineup. So that's how I've been doing it. But I think this is only the second one, or this is only the second one I will have been playing in. So, but. Tough question here from Nancy Drew Guy. How do you build your skills? How do you get away from being an average player to being a better player? I guess what I'm saying is, how do you build your skills when DFS is primarily based on luck? I don't know if I agree with the idea that DFS is primarily based on luck. There is a lot on any given slate. there is an immense amount of luck of who takes down that slate. But the longer your time horizon is, the longer your sample size is, the more skill expression comes out, right? It is not as if the most skilled player makes the highest expected value lineup on a given slate and then proceeds to win. The winning lineup on any given night does need a lot of bit of luck to get by. But over the long term, I mean, we can see it just based on the fact that there are profitable DFS players, that not everybody loses to the rake, that there is skill expression in DFS. In fact, that's why DFS is still around, to be completely honest, is that the government has agreed that it is a game of skill, which lets it continue to exist. So, but in terms of how do you build your skills, I think this is a tough question and this is a big question. I'll start by saying our goal with our content is to, it's very easy for me to come up here and answer questions like, how do I make stacks? How do I manage my exposures? How do I do things? But the questions of what to do quickly become a lot harder, especially on SaberSim, because SaberSim is automating a lot of the things that would make up a full, complete process for somebody else on a traditional optimizer, right? If you sat down with a traditional optimizer and you were trying to get into baseball DFS, well, the first thing you would have to learn, at least the first thing I think you would probably have to learn, is correlation, right? It's a high correlation sport. You'd have to learn how you're going to take into account that edge. You would also then very quickly have to learn how to manage your ownership. Right? There's increased relative value on low owned fantasy points. So you need to account for ownership. How are you going to do that? Right? And you also need to account for variance. Not every player scores their average projection all of the time. In fact, most players score around their average projection very rarely in terms of their overall range of outcomes. How are you going to account for that? Right? Dealing with those individual things often represents somebody's entire process for baseball DFS. And that's really pretty well automated for you on SaberSim and adjusted on a per contest and per slate size level. So a lot of that heavy lifting here is being automated there for you. I think there are a handful of ways to continue to add value on top of that. I don't even want to say a handful. There's a lot of different ways to continue to add value on top of that. I think for me in particular, I often see, trying to think about the right way to put this. I think there are two, I don't even want to say there's two clear paths, but there are two kind of strategic ways of adding value to SaberSim that I often see presented. And the first is actually going in and spending time and looking at the individual inputs. And I think this is going to require some knowledge of the sport. But if you are a big baseball fan, if you follow the sport, I think spending time and looking at the projections, the ownership projections, but also the detailed projections, and asking yourself if you agree with these inputs can be a way to add value. So Max basically broke down this kind of way of thinking for basketball. So in our basketball course from last year, Max recorded this video called How to Beat Daily Fantasy Basketball Like an NBA DFS Pro. And what Max does, boiled down in a nutshell, is in the NBA, he will study the rotations and the minutes projections for teams where there is a lot of murkiness, where maybe clear players are ruled out or core players are ruled out, or maybe it's a team, maybe after a trade, or a team that otherwise maybe is playing a little bit differently, and really dives into the rotations that team has used recently and the minutes projections on SaberSim and makes adjustments to player projections based on that. Right. Another way of doing that would be for baseball, I guess, would be looking into pitcher pitch counts. Now, we have logic on our end to pick up when pitchers are on a pitch count. But doing a little bit of additional research into pitch counts, if you're getting a lot of exposure to a pitcher, doing a little bit of extra research to make sure that guy's not on a pitch count, I think can add some value. I also think digging into kind of more advanced research on, how pitchers have changed, I think, can be a good value. So sometimes a sudden drop in velocity can be an indication that maybe a pitcher is dealing with a injury. There is information out there about pitcher spin rates, which I know was pretty popular last year, especially with the sticky substance drama right? There was changing spin rates for pitchers throughout the year, right? Our model is very good, but it is not going to pick up on all of the individual buzz that's going on for a particular team or for particular players throughout the season. And one way I think you can add value is studying, or another one is, I guess, more broadly on the team level. And this is something that I've experimented with a little bit myself here, is looking at Vegas and particularly Vegas movement and seeing how the Vegas financial market is looking at different teams on a particular slate. So one way that I've liked to do this in the past is to go over here and pull up the slate here and scan for games where we have, you know, a difference compared to Vegas, but also to look for situations where Vegas, not only are we different from Vegas, but we're moving in the opposite direction. And I'm going to see if I can find an example here. But I may not be able to for tonight's slate. The closest thing I can see to it is we have the Angels at 4.4 runs. They opened at 4.5 and have moved up to 4.6. So not a really good example, to be honest, but a decent example of what I'm describing here. This may be an indication that our model is not picking something up with this game, right? That we're missing something. It could be anything. It could be a park factor that we're underweighting. It could be maybe there's a pitcher that's been elite recently this season or the opposite and has better long-term form, or there's an immense amount of sharp money that's moving in, or even not even sharp money, just big money that's moving the line that already started away from us, further away from us. I think that can be a good key to look into. I think ownership is another one as well, right? We've put some work into our ownership model this year. We're continuing to do more moving forward, but we are not always going to pick up ownership perfectly, especially on a per contest level. If you're playing single entries or live qualifiers or some of these more niche contests, ownership is going to condense a little bit more. And in a sport like baseball, where the ownership is being valued very highly based on the default settings, updating the ownership projections and even just being directionally correct, right? So saying something like, I think that Charlie Morton is going to be higher than 30%. It doesn't even matter what you actually put him at. Even 35% will add value, right? So that's kind of one way that I think you can start to add value here. And that's through your own independent research. Now, if you are deer in the headlights here, right, like I don't know how to do that, then maybe that's not an opportunity to add value, right, for you, for your particular skill set. Because again, I think SaberSim's model and all models in general are probably going to take you 90% of the way there. Picking up that last remaining 10% is going to be more about how much time do you have to do it, right? And where do you want to go and look at these things? The other way, and I think the way that is a little bit more in line with the way that I approach DFS, is to assume that in general, the models and the simulations are going to pick up enough of that stuff on their own, that that's not a big opportunity to add too much value, but to instead make adjustments on the other side, on step three or after the build, right? SaberSim is basically, when you come in here and build, it's going to say, okay, based on this is an 8-game slate, based on these projections and these simulations, let's actually go back here, right? Based on all these different things, this is the optimal way to play the slate, right? So let's actually do a fresh build, because I don't have a build that doesn't have a stack rule built in it yet. So if you come in here and say, I'm building for a 20 max, right? And so 20 max, 10 to 50K, maybe this is the $4 20 max, right? SaberSim is going to build 500 lineups and then find the best 20 and say, these are the highest expected value lineups to take with you into this particular contest. But in general, you'll see that your pool of 500 lineups is very, very diverse. I'll show you in a second, but you can play, especially in a sport like baseball, virtually any pitcher you want, any stack you want, really. There's a ton of diversity in your pool. And the difference in expected value of these lineups here is pretty small, right? When I say your entire pool of 500 lineups is viable, I really mean that, right? So one of the primary ways that I think about my DFS play in general is assuming that the projections are for the most part accurate, right? That's picking up most of what is important about the slate, but approaching what lineups I want to actually take with me into my contests is up to me, right? That I've decided on what basically the best lineups are to take with me into into the contests, right? And that is why research builds are such a core part of my process. Is if I'm in a pinch and I have no time, I will trust SaberSim and take the top 20 lineups with me and roll with them and feel like they are probably pretty good lineups for that particular slate. But if I have more time, I often want to run that 0-0-10 big research build because I want to see what the slate looks like as a whole, and then I can decide where I want to take my stance, right? Maybe I have decided that a particular leverage play... Here, you know what? Let's use Baltimore as an example, right? Maybe I've decided that I want to have a little bit of exposure to Baltimore because I think there's way too much exposure to Jordan Montgomery, and I want to leverage directly against that. Right. That's not so much of a stand against. That's not saying, you know, Montgomery's pitch velocity is down or I think he's a bad pitcher or something like that on the projection side. That's me saying that I think the most profitable way to build 20 lineups for this contest, for this slate, is to leverage against directly against that pitching chalk. Right. And maybe I do a little bit of that there. So that is why research builds are so core to my process, to the way I approach DFS in all sports. And I always end up coming on here to talk about that is because that's just my skill set. Is I like to exploit ownership in that way. I like to see a wide open ownership correlation, unadjusted view of the slate, see how often players and teams are in the optimal, and use that knowledge to add a little bit of additional value in step three, right? So, but this is a tough question of how to get better. And that's why we have, you know, multiple hour-long videos on different sports and subjects, because it's a complicated question to answer. I'll start to wrap this question up and say this. I think the best, and I would say that the best way you can immediately start to get better at DFS is to make sure that you are playing your lineups into the best contests that are out there for you. So if it's baseball, basketball, whatever you're still playing at this point in the season, if you haven't watched our contest selection videos, definitely watch those and make sure that you are playing into the best contests possible. From there, I would say, you know, having a strong understanding of what SaberSim is doing here and having a strong understanding of what the individual sliders do is helpful in that it will help you understand the things that aren't as much worth spending your time on. Right, I don't spend a ton of time on dialing in stack rules because I'm pretty trusting of the correlation slider, right, for example. And then from there, I think you can start to explore the ideas of doing a little bit more research into the individual projections, and especially for pitchers and ownership on step one, or spending a little bit more time on step three to either diversify, manage your risk there, or to make different strategic decisions based on your own particular research. So... but hopefully that was somewhat helpful there. Move on from there. Nick had said I was doing NHL totals on FanDuel, but when I switched to DK, it reset and I had to change them all again. These are the team totals that I adjusted manually. Is there a way to save it since it's just team totals? There isn't, unfortunately, at the moment. That's a pretty common request. That is on our list to add in the future. But there's not, if you are playing multiple sites and adjusting team totals, you do for now have to do those manually, unfortunately. It's the same thing jumping between different slates. So if you've adjusted team totals on step one for the main slate and then want to do the night slate, you do have to do that manually for now as well. So, but that's on our list to improve in the future. Adam said, the analogy to the max video basketball value add, to what extent is adjusting 1x player projections in a game going to impact how the whole game is simmed? In other words, if I want to adjust a starting pitcher or a batter or two, will changing their projection affect how everyone correlates with them? Or is it better to just change the whole game total? Really good question. So for baseball in particular, I prefer to actually work with the game totals. So let's say you actually did some research and, let me look. Let's keep using the Jordan Montgomery example, right? So let's say you did some some research and you decided that you wanted to be a little under on Montgomery or thought there was something that the model wasn't picking up or something to that effect, right? The way I would actually go about doing that is making an adjustment to the Baltimore team total. And what I like to do is to start with a half game, half run adjustment and seeing the impact of that. So, and what's nice about that is you'll get the correlated adjustment as you would expect. So Montgomery's projection comes down actually by quite a bit, over 10% of an adjustment here. And the Orioles batters all will also go up, right? And what's nice is they go up in accordance with what their original projection was, with what their spot in the batting order is. My favorite way to make adjustments on baseball projections are using the team totals. I actually would probably in general recommend not making individual player projection updates most of the time, unless there's a very specific thing that you think that the model is not picking up on a player. If you like the environment for a hitter or want to bump their projection in general, I would bump their whole team and I would do the opposite for pitchers. So, but good question. Patrick said, will you guys develop an iOS or Android app for SaberSim? Doing a CSV late swap app is a pain on a mobile web browser. We actually spent a lot of time last fall doing a full site app redesign for the mobile browser to make it as painless as possible. So it is not really on our roadmap to do an iOS and Android app. And in fact, I would be interested to hear a little bit more. I mean, you can tell me in here in YouTube chat or maybe even in our, you know, the wish list channel in Slack or something like that. If there's particular pain points that are difficult when you are late swapping on mobile, let us know, because we actually spent a lot of time last year to make those adjustments and to try to improve the mobile experience. So a little dismayed to hear that you don't like it, because we actually put a lot of work in this past fall to try to improve that. So we'd be happy to hear about ways that we could continue to make that a little bit better. If there's things that are particularly painful, some of that is limitations on the sites, right? Like DraftKings and FanDuel do not really make it that easy, I don't think, to do mobile adjustments themselves, especially FanDuel. You have to do, I mean, even just to see the CSV edit button, you have to do some like desktop and landscape view on your phone wizardry to get that to pull up. They don't let you use the apps to do CSV edits either, which I don't understand exactly why, mostly because they already have functional apps, right? I don't know why there's no CSV options on those apps, but we are a little bit at the whims of the sites, but we have tried to make the experience on the Saber side as mobile friendly as possible. So if there are pain points, definitely let us know and we can take another look. Tracy said, you often state that Saber accounts for a lot of things in the model. Can you name a few things that it doesn't account for to help me gain an edge on the field? Yeah, so this is a difficult question to answer. Mostly because it is not as if there are things out there that we believe are predictive, that are useful to research, that we have just arbitrarily decided not to include in our own model. Just because, right? Like it would be very easy to say, oh, we don't take into account park factors at all. So go research park factors and make adjustments to projections. The reason why is because once we identify that something is important like that, we do try to pull it into the model and incorporate it into the sims, right? I would say you are going to be better off looking for situations that are inherently difficult to model for any model for a sport, right? And those are going to be, I think, situations where something has changed about the game state compared to what the historical background of that data is. So anytime you have a player that is returning from injury or maybe is dealing with an injury, that is inherently going to be a difficult situation to project. So I think a decent example is Shane Bieber this year, right? Was hurt a lot last year, is here this year. There is data out there that says the velocity on his pitches is down, right? Well, that's something that is going to be difficult for, I mean, you can understand that the pitch velocity is down, but that's not something that the model is going to take into account, right? That's an injury. The actual impact on what that's happening on his performance is difficult to explain very easily, right? Injuries in general are difficult to project because they are inherently unpredictable. Another example I think that's interesting for this season is the Camden Yards change, right? So I know that this game is being played at Yankee Stadium, but the Orioles pulled the left field walls back quite a bit before the start of the season. That is a difficult situation to understand how that park factor is going to play to start the season, right? We can approximate that, and we can, in general, try to make educated guesses on how that park is going to play. But when you've went from having however long Camden Yards has been in play, right, years and years of data about how a particular park affects the game played there, and suddenly that's changed, that's an inherently difficult situation to model. Weather can be tough, right? I think Kevin Roth does a pretty good job of assessing weather risk. I like his stuff, but games with significant wind or rain or precipitation can also be a difficult situation to model, right? That is, weather is inherently pretty chaotic and pretty difficult to predict very accurately. So while we can in general, know that the wind blowing out in a Wrigley Field game is going to promote hitting performance, if that wind is changing dramatically, right, throughout the game, or, a wind that is supposed to be blowing out to right that slightly changes to more left-right across the field is going to change the way that that game plays significantly. So any of these situations where you can come up with something where it's not that it is a factor that has predictive value that we have just chosen to not include, but instead a situation that is inherently hard to model by anyone, and spending a little bit more time to look at those particular teams, look at the team totals, look at the player projections, look at the ownership, and see if you agree based on your own research, that's the best opportunities, I think, to add value. So I would say injuries, paying attention to injury news and seeing how recently injured players or how players that are known to be playing with an injury or anything like that are projected. I think weather for baseball in particular is a good one. And the last one I'll add there is young players in general, players that don't have a lot of back history in the majors, even really can be a good opportunity to do a little bit more research. So I know that's not maybe specifically the answer that people want when they ask this question. It would be a lot easier for me to say something like, park factors, right? The example I gave before, go research that and then adjust based on that. But the reason why this question is hard to answer in that way is because we work very hard on our end to include as much as possible there already, which means the remainder of what is left to research and to make sharp adjustments for is by definition, the harder things to go dig up. But anyway, I hope that was somewhat helpful there. AK said, I use Firefox. It's very simple to use the swap. On DK, I just download the lineup first and then do the open tab to DK, because on mobile, it opens the next browser and you always have to go back to click download again. So I usually set my lineup on the PC first, then have both SaberSim and the upload page on DK open on mobile. If I'm on the go, I can usually late swap in a couple minutes. Patrick said FanDuel is the trickiest. Yeah, and FanDuel is just difficult on their end. Like, it's hard because we can't directly download the CSV, right? When you click download template file from FanDuel, you have to go to FanDuel, and then the CSV edit button isn't even visible on their site until you turn your phone into landscape mode or put it into the desktop mode, and then you can download it and re-upload. So there are certain limitations for what we can do on the FanDuel late swap just because of the way that they've set up their sites. So. Okay, cool. What other questions do we have here today? We have probably five or so more minutes on today's stream. Any other questions for me? Been a good stream. You guys have kept me on my toes here today. Some interesting questions here about what to research, where to spend time digging in, how to just improve broadly at DFS. We also talked a little bit, or I guess also a little bit about variance and expectations of how often to win. We talked a little bit about setting stack rules and also researching stack ownership. So been a fun stream here today. I will remind everybody here as we begin to close out here for today to subscribe to the YouTube channel to get notifications every time I go live. So you're always ready for the next stream. If you are watching this and haven't checked out SaberSim already, we have a free 7-day trial at sabersim.com. You can come check us out. No strings attached. Try us for 7 days. If you don't like it, you can cancel. We won't charge you, but hopefully you love it. We also have the props plans ongoing. So still some NBA, some time left for the NBA season. The baseball prop betting model here is getting very close to, or not even the prop betting model, the prop betting plan is getting very close to being ready for the 2022 season. So if you want to get on the wait list for the MLB prop betting plan, just DM any of us in Slack, anyone, Ross, me, Chris, Ruben, anybody, and we'll get you onto the wait list for the baseball prop betting plan. Those plans are basically what you are seeing in the sports betting channel in Slack, the free bet of the day, but we'll post anywhere from 3 to 10 of our favorite prop bets for that particular day in those private channels. So we'll go ahead. I see one more question came in from Patrick. We'll make this our last question of the day. He said, late swap is more efficient for a large slate in NBA. I noticed it doesn't matter as much for the 2 to 3 game slate. Late swap at this point in the NBA season, I think matters less a little bit because of the slate size, probably more so just because of the playoffs, right? Teams are playing their best players. Right, you are generally getting the best starting five for every single game at this point in the year because every game matters. In the regular season, you have guys getting rested, you have guys that will get scratched, different things like that. If a guy is hurt, he's not going to play, but if he can play, they are going to play the games because these games matter. I think the secondary factor there is yes, on smaller slates in general, even in the regular season, late swap is a little bit less of a factor just because there's less games on the slate. It's less likely that there is a significant value opportunity opened up because of late swap. But I think at this point in the season, the primary factor there is that late swap is a little less valuable just because we don't have that surprise news. We generally know who's going to be playing every single night. So for me, as somebody who preaches how much I love late swap and how much I think it is an enormous edge in regular season, I have shifted a little bit more to really being intentional and intentionally trying to leverage against ownership and playing a little bit more of an exploitative strategy for my NBA lineups to get a little bit of an additional edge there where late swap, I think, is a little bit less valuable at this particular point of the season. You still have to do it. If there is news that breaks, if things change, I will still do late swap, but I am counting less on there being a huge edge opportunity when I'm playing NBA at this point in the season. So, but good question. We'll go ahead. We'll wrap it up there. I will be right back here again tomorrow. Same time, same place, 2 p.m. Eastern. So thanks for tuning in here today. Good luck in the main slate tonight, and I will see you guys tomorrow. Take care.